This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice for Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Although we are not live in studio, here's the deal. It's brand new to you content. That's right. A brand new show you have not heard right here on AM 950. Thanks for being with us this holiday season and happy holidays. Merry Christmas to everyone in Minneapolis, St. Paul. As a matter of fact, I got this one message here. Thank you, AM 950, for all the enjoyable content. You make my life better. Reed from Minnetonka. Reed, my absolute pleasure. Happy holidays to you, my friend. This hour, this entire hour, the 4 o'clock hour, Dolores Pringle. She's a trustee with the Penn Center in South Carolina. Now, if you don't remember, I interviewed her back in September. The Penn Center is such an important piece of African American history in this country. We need to talk about it. We need to make sure people understand the importance of the Penn Center. We're going to talk with Dolores the entire 4 o'clock hour right here on AM 950. So when we come back, Dolores Pringle joins us for the 4 o'clock hour right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Hope you're having wonderful holidays out there. Now, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know my next guest from back in August, and we had her on because, my God, sometimes you have an experience when you go on a vacation and you visit a location, an historic site, and you realize, wow, not only is this an important historic site for its nature, but it's an historic site that I think a lot of people know nothing about, but it's so important for us to understand more about. And that was the location was the Penn Center. It's located on St. Helena's Island, right outside of Beaufort, South Carolina. It's a gorgeous place. Go visit. It's absolutely gorgeous down there. But the Penn Center itself is an epicenter of so much history, especially Black history, that the story has to be told. And we had Last August, Dolores Pringle on. She's a trustee from the Penn Center. I said to her back then, we didn't even get close to finish talking about all the stuff I wanted to talk about. And so I promised I'd have her back for the holidays. And she's kind enough to join us to talk more once again about the Penn Center on St. Helena Island. Dolores, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Well, thank you, Matt. And happy holidays to everyone.
And happy holidays to you and everyone down in South Carolina. The important thing to understand about the Penn Center and the uniqueness of the historical content here is that it's not when we're talking about the U.S. government, the decision, what we have to do, we want to try to do something for the former slaves. We were not talking about freed slaves because of the Penn Center, St. Helena Island, Beaufort, South Carolina, because of the unique nature of the history which happened there, these were technically abandoned slaves, correct?
That is absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. Right. And the word that they were using back then was contraband.
Okay.
That the military was using.
And because
contraband of war.
And what had happened is after Fort Sumter fell, the North sailed into Beaufort Harbor, took over that area, and then never surrendered it the entire war. So quite literally, it was an outpost for the North. There, most of the white slave owners left and left behind their plantations, which once again presented. Do you know off the top of your head how many abandoned slaves were there in that region at the time the U.S. Army was there?
Oh, my gosh. It was thousands. And it is documented in some of the literature, and I'm thinking maybe somewhere around 8,000 to 10,000.
Wow.
Off the top of my head, I may be incorrect with those numbers, but there were thousands of slaves abandoned.
Wow.
Not just on the St. Helena side of the county, but also on the what we call the southern side of the county, which is Head.
The it presented a unique, problem for the North. What do we do now if we're freeing the slaves? What do we, that's eventually the end goal and eventually where we did get. But, it gave them the ability to create a template of how to deal with the soon to be freed slaves, in the case of that region, the abandoned slaves, and get them ready for society, which is kind of the early beginnings of the Penn Center.
Right, you're absolutely correct, and that is known as the Port Royal Experiment. And as I stated before, when the Union Army came across the Port Royal Sound, which is one of the largest, I think, next to New York, natural harbors in the country, they found all of these abandoned slaves, as you mentioned, because the planters, the slaves, had always outnumbered their owners, and the owners really realized after the first bombardment that there's no way that they could stand against, that kind of army that the Union represented, and so they, they left and left all of these slaves behind, and so there were people in the North who had always believed that if slaves were freed, that they could become, they could be educated, they could become landowners, and they could become first-class citizens. And so when the soldiers came ashore and found all of these abandoned slaves, they telegraphed up back north to some of the abolitionists and said, we have found your experiment. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's called the Port Royal Experiment. And so they sent down these two women, Laura Towne and Ellen Murray, who founded Penn Center. The school was officially founded in 1862. There's another story that kind of parallels this one. Again, on the south side of the county, on Hilton Head, because at the same time, there was another big 1862 event, and that was the founding of the first black town in this country, black-run town. And it is called Mitchellville. And the next time you come down, Matt, to visit your parents, you really should visit Mitchellville as well.
I will.
It's a site that has preserved, and it's on Hilton Head. And it's named after General Mitchell, who set aside the land for the slaves who were on that side of the county. And they built a town, and they named it after Mitchellville. After General Mitchell, I'm sorry, and it's called Mitchellville. And so that is really worth your audience ever venture down to Hilton Head. That's also worth visiting.
One of the things which I like about the story is the people that were behind this founding of not only Mitchellville, but also of Penn Center and the Port Royal Experiment, is the war against ignorance. The idea that was held by a lot of whites in the South, that you could not educate the African-American population. They could not run a town on their own. And this was a specific step forward to show, no, your ignorance, your bigotry is wrong. This is just, we just need to give them the opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that held up so incredibly well and still is holding up today. And I like to point out, because there's a misconception that the slaves who became landowners, that they were given that land after the planters abandoned the plantations. They were not given that land. They bought it.
Yes.
They bought the land, but they were allowed to enlarge parcels so that families could live on the land. And those are called family compounds, and we still have lots of those in the Lowcountry today, family compounds, where people live on a large portions of land, but they're all related. There was a system that was put in place called free labor, and it was put in place by a guy out of Boston, Philbrick. And he allowed he created a system where the slaves could work for their wages. Mm-hmm. And they worked in the cotton fields, and at that time there was phosphate mining going on in that area, and they worked in the phosphate mines. And they earned their monies, and they bought that land. No one gave them land.
And,
they bought it.
And with this, it really was changing the dynamic of the South. And we're going to get to, I mean, if you're listening to this and you're saying, wow, this sounds great, how did this not catch on? We'll get to that here in just a second because of the smack back from the white Southerners, really. But the reality is this was – the promise here was it was really significant that you could buy your own land, you could get an education, you could run your own towns. It really was, this brave idea, which it sounds very progressive today even, and here it was being installed in the early parts of the Civil War.
Absolutely, but the sad part of it, Matt, is that despite the importance of Reconstruction, many Americans know very little about it.
Mm-hmm.
It is, what they do know about it is outdated and inaccurate. And for too many years, historians portrayed the period as a failure, and they defined it narrowly. But there were so many triumphs, as you mentioned, and so many successes, and especially in that part of the country, on the sea islands of South Carolina, and in particularly on an island like St. Helena, where that school, I mean, and I'm not just saying this because I'm a trustee of the organization, but that Penn Center is probably the most important African-American historical and cultural institution in the country.
I'm not going to disagree with that. I'm not going to disagree with that because, yeah. I mean, because it's such a multi-layered history, and we'll get to more of the later history with it. The significance it represents for when I, and as you and I talked back in August, I went in there. I was like, how in the world is this not a stop on every major historical tour, white or black, in this country?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. I'm so glad. I am so glad that you said that. And we've got to continue through programs like yours, spread the word about this incredible place that has all of this incredible history. But as much as that history is still there in place, on that landmark site, when you delve into Penn Center's archives, you are just blown over. And remember, we have an amazing archival collection of over 3,000 photographs and manuscripts and diaries and writings and letters. It's all housed in the Southern Collection at UNC Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And, scholars and people from all over the world come and access archives. It is one of the most used archives at UNC Chapel Hill. So it's not just, in addition to actual physical landmark site, we've got all of the the collections and the archival materials to back up the story.
Mm-hmm. For a person that's going down there and wants to visit the Penn Center, let's describe exactly what they'll see. They'll get there, and there are some buildings which are they're not the original buildings. There are remakes but are still quite old, correct?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And the buildings there were all built by the students. And I'd like to also point out that when Penn Center was first founded, and it's called Penn Center after, it's named after William Penn.
Yes.
The great Quaker.
Yes.
Of Pennsylvania, because he believed in the brotherhood of man. And one of the people that he sent down, Lord Town, had Quaker connections. The other one, Ellen Murray, was a Unitarian Universalist church. When they first founded the school, I mean, they actually operated out of a plantation called the Oaks Plantation, where the officers housed. And then they moved from the Oaks over to Brick Church, which had been a white church, but when the planters left, the former slaves took the church over. Beautiful church, I'm sure you saw that mm-hmm. as well. It's right across. It's almost on Penn Center's campus. Mm-hmm. And then after being at Brick Church for a while, that is when they really moved to the present site, which is a 50-acre site. But the amazing story about that site, and I told it the last time that we spoke, is that that site, that 50-acre site that we are located on right now today, was given to Penn Center by a former slave, Hastings Gant. Hastings Gant was a slave who was emancipated. But again, to show what freedom can do, he became a legislator in the South Carolina legislature during Reconstruction, but he became a wealthy man because he bought land and he grew cotton and he raised cattle, and then he bought more land, raised more cattle, grew more cotton, and he became got to the point where he could become a philanthropist. He gave the land for the building of the school where it is located now. A former slave, Hastings mm-hmm. Gant. And so all of the buildings were built by the students. Some of the buildings, a couple of the buildings over the years, you know, or maybe was destroyed. One, I think, was destroyed by a hurricane coming through.
Yeah.
And I think Founders Hall maybe was burned. But all of the buildings, every single building, we've got about 23 structures on site, and all of those buildings are historic buildings, and that is what makes us a landmark district. And there are only three landmark districts in South Carolina: City of Charleston, which everybody knows
yeah.
about Charleston and that history, and City of Beaufort, and then there is Penn Center.
One of the things I love about the Penn Center is the education that was given, which, by the way, I think we need. I mean, once again, talk about progressive for the time. I think we could actually install the lesson plans of the Penn Center from then to today and actually have a lot of good use, the ability for people to learn whatever it might be, auto mechanics, building, construction, farming, agriculture, working at preserving, crops and making sure you had them. I mean, there was along with the regular traditional education we know of, there was this wealth of understanding of just basically taking a slave and saying, okay, this is what you're going to, here are the day-to-day use things you are going to need. And my God, is that an important, just talk about the history towards education and what we could learn today. I mean, it was progressive for the time, and it truly gave a lot of the black community a incredible education, which helped them throughout their lives.
Oh, absolutely. And when Lardtown and Ellen Murray first started the school, you know, they were teaching a classic kind of New England curriculum. But then that changed. We had people on Penn Center's board like Hollis Fazell, who was the president of Hampton, what was called Hampton Institute then, and Booker T. Washington, you know, Tuskegee, and we even had George Peabody, who the great Peabody Award is named after. He was the treasurer of Penn Center and a quite wealthy man. They decided to adopt the Hampton and the Tuskegee models of education, which is the one that you just described, the agriculture, you know, the trades, the building, the crafts, and but still teaching, you know, the basic tenets of education. And I mean, and that produced such wonderful students and citizens and people who went on to make their mark in the world. A lot of the students migrated north, worked as nurses and worked in the north, and then doing this return migration pattern, a lot of them returned back to the area, and a lot of them had second careers on the island.
And then as well, the job that the Penn Center has done, not only in the education, but the preservation, the Gullah community, the Gullah culture, the language, the medicines, the foods, these were things which, you know, in a lot of cultures, and of course up here in Minnesota, we see this a lot with the Native American tribes, where a lot of their culture is gone. It's disappeared. The Penn Center took it upon themselves to make sure that Gullah community, that Gullah culture, which was prevalent from the freed slaves, that basically stayed and was preserved over time.
Oh, absolutely, and did it purposefully. We worked at preserving the Gullah Geechee culture, and we still do. Mm-hmm. Still goes on. Even one of the amazing projects that Penn Center was involved in, and I'm not sure whether you purchased it or not, but was the Bible project. You know, we've interpreted the Bible, the New Testament, all in Gullah. We sell it in our bookstore at the visitor center, and I mean that is language. Mm-hmm. That itself is such language that anyone can Gullah language that anyone can delve into because it is the Bible. And we worked with the American Bible Association. It was a 15-year project to do that a translation of the Bible into Gullah language. And so that is something that is easily accessible. I mean, people can buy it on Amazon or buy it when they visit Penn. But there are all kinds of ways in which we have preserved the culture through the crafts, through the, of course, the basket weaving and the bateau making and the net making and the wood carvings. We've worked at preserving this culture
and
passing it.
Well, and Dolores, you and I could talk another entire hour just on the Gullah culture because that's wonderful. I mean, this is like I said, when you go there and you realize the volume of history that is just not taught anywhere else, it is pretty astounding. We have got to get into a little bit more modern, especially Martin Luther King. And also a project that the Penn Center has been, you know, protecting the landowners in the region. That is, I think, a top-notch program there that we did not get to talk about last time. Dolores Pringle, once again, is a trustee from the Penn Center. We do need to take a break, though. We'll come back another segment coming up with Dolores and the Penn Center. I do want to encourage you, go to Penn Center, find their website. We'll get the website for you. I want you to make a donation, become a member, make a plan to go visit this location because it's so important. We'll get all that information as well in the next segment. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, continuing our interview with Dolores Pringle. She's a trustee from the Penn Center, an amazing historic site located on St. Helena Island, right on near Beaufort, South Carolina, one that I highly encourage you to go visit because it is so important as far as history goes. We talked a little bit in the last segment about the original early history of the Penn Center and the beginnings of change there. Of course, a lot of that never grabbed hold because after Reconstruction and with the pushback from the white community, a lot of the great programs and projects that were discovered at the Penn Center, Dolores, never were able to take hold across the rest of the South.
Yes, absolutely. And if they were able to, especially the land policies, if the land policies had just been replicated in other parts of the country, we never would have had, you know, the disgraceful practice of sharecropping that cropped up in other parts of the South. But the land policies that were carved out, especially on St. Helena, where, you know, former slaves were allowed to buy large plots of land, that disgraceful practice never would have occurred in other parts of the South after the Civil War.
The Penn Center remained a stellar achievement, even as the rest of the South never did pick up on a lot of your trend setting ways, whether in the Civil War and the days afterward, the decades afterwards. But the Penn Center maintained its cause and its purpose. It became a bit of a respite area for Martin Luther King Jr. He spent a lot of time there, correct?
Oh, absolutely. It was his R&R location. He felt safe there. He felt protected. The islanders, of course, protected him. And he could relax there. He played baseball with the community members. He did a lot of his... He rested. He did a lot of his writings, did a lot of training and planning for the movement at Penn Center. And he came so often to Penn Center until whenever he would come, he would always select the smallest cottage that we had, which is named for Hastings Gant, the remarkable man that I was talking about earlier. But he would stay in Gant Cottage, which was the smallest cottage, as I said, that we had. But the community and Penn Center decided that they wanted to build him his own lodging at Penn Center just for him. So they built him this house in an incredible location, very private location, on Penn Center's waterfront. But just as that house was completed, he was assassinated. He never had a chance to live in that facility. And so we started calling it King Cottage, and today it is referred to more as Retreat House. I'm not sure you saw that when you were there, because you have to travel a ways through the property to get to it. But it is a beautiful location, right on the banks of the water. But he would have so thoroughly enjoyed that resting and planning at that location. But he and his lieutenants, Jesse, we have pictures of him and of Martin Luther King and all his lieutenants, Jesse Jackson, Andrew Young, all of his lieutenants coming down to Penn Center. And planning during that time. And I think that the meetings weren't always, you know, smooth sailing. I think that they differed. I think that they had different ideas about what direction that they should go into, for the movement. And we have some of those pitches, those deliberations of those pitches. Mm-hmm. And the amazing thing is that we have pictures of MLK at Penn Center out of his uniform. His uniform was a suit and tie. But we have pictures of him at Penn Center, you know, in short sleeve shirts or in sweaters, which is unusual. If you look at the many pictures of him, you just don't see him in that like that
well,
often.
And you know, it's easy to see how that is the case, though, when you mentioned to us last time Penn Center in the 50s and 60s was one of only two places in the South where whites and blacks could sit down and discuss race issues without the fear of you know, something bad happening. When you describe MLK Jr. being there, you know, and being able to relax, there's a reason why. It's because Penn Center was leading the way in being a location where we could have discussions about race.
Oh, absolutely. And the other place was the Highlander Center up in Tennessee. But like I said, he felt very, very comfortable and very safe. And of course, the islanders, you know, looked after him. And so those were some amazing years. And after he was assassinated, the Penn Center staff found portions of the I Have a Dream speech in Gant Cottage, and they handed it over to the King family. But those were some amazing years. And in recent years, I guess maybe about when I used to be the chair of the Penn Center board, and when I was the chair of the board, we started something called the 1862 Circle, and oldie, that's been about maybe, 15 or 18 years ago, and we started inducting many of the people into that circle from the Penn Center with MLK. The first person was Vernon Jordan, and then John Lewis, and Andy Young, and, you know, even Marion Wright Elderman. So a lot of the people who was a part of the group that would come to Penn Center, we've, you know, gone on and continued our relationships with them. We were going to induct Jesse Jackson into the 1862 Circle just the year that COVID hit us, and we had to cancel that event. But so we maintained our relationship with the with many of the people who would come with him to Penn Center, and we have an oral history project where we're trying to gather as many of those oral histories as we possibly can do for that era.
There is this god-awful, ugly element of America right now that is screaming against, you know, whether it's called critical race theory or this, but it's the mentality that, if I can be bold enough, ignorant people can scream away reality. They don't want to be heard. And this is, as I discover the Penn Center, and I discover the rich, important, incredibly important history of the Penn Center on all these levels. Talk a little bit about that, because this is a disturbing trend that people, they for whatever reason, shame, fear, anger, racism, for whatever reason, they want to stop the history from being talked about, not a bias history, but just the actual history. They want their whitewashed version of it, quite literally, whitewashed version of history. They don't want to hear about how Hastings Gantt was a good person, or the Port Royal experiment was a success if it had only been applied everywhere else. They want to basically believe that the history that they want to be true is true. Talk a little bit about that, because this is a big fight ahead of us, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And it is so, and like you said, it is very disturbing, and it's very, very sad. And that is why organizations like Penn Center is so important. Because if we're not careful, the story will be retold in ways that is actually, you know, not correct. And but thank God that we've got, you know, organizations like Penn Center, we've got collections like Penn Center's archives, and Penn Center isn't the only organization, but it certainly is a pivotal organization to continue to tell the story. Because if we're careful, we will let other people rewrite history and retell the story in ways, like you said, that makes them feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And that's not what history is all about.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, history is not about making people feel good or feel comfortable. History is about telling a story that happened, and if that story was if that story was a story that doesn't fit with what we're supposed to be in terms of democracy, you know, the answer is not to just wipe out that history. The answer is to understand it so that it will never happen again.
Amen. Amen.
And that's the beauty of history. And I mean, I'm a history major, and for a time in my life, I taught U.S. history and African American history, and I love teaching history, and I love opening students' eyes to how important it is. And that old adage, Matt, about if you don't understand it, if you don't know it, you will repeat it.
Yes.
That's what we see happening a lot right now. It is quite disturbing and concerning what is happening.
No, it is.
And one of the most disturbing things about it is it's like, and excuse my expression for saying this on your radio show, but it's like democracy be damned. They don't care about democracy anymore.
No, they want their narrative validated.
Yes, absolutely.
No, they want their narrative validated, and they don't care about the. And if the history doesn't match their narrative, well, then they'll wipe the history out. And my God, how many times on the planet have we seen that exact scenario happen? And it's going on again right now. You said it perfectly. History is not pretty, but it's the way that we react to what has happened with the full knowledge of what has happened that makes us better people. And that's what you have to do. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person because something historically bad happened. It means that you've learned, oh, well, that was bad. Let's not do that again. let's move past that again and move forward. And I think that's the important part. And that's why the Penn Center is so important. I've got to get to something here, Dolores, that I think is so important. And that is the we're talking about the importance of preserving the land ownership for the families of the former slaves and basically making sure that that their land stays their land. And this resonated when I heard about this project the Penn Center has tackled here. I was so impressed because up here in Minnesota we have a lot of lakes and we have a lot of original landowners who basically get wined and dined and sweet talked, and basically they find them all of a sudden one day they don't own that lakefront property anymore, and the next day a big McMansion goes up on top of it of some wealthy person that's bought out that land. There has been a project at the Penn Center, which is amazing, that you have gone out there and worked with the original landowners to preserve as much of the property for them as possible. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. And we've been doing that for years. We're probably the grandfather project entry in terms of trying to save heirs' property land. And it's important that we do it. There was a time when you know, people didn't even care about coastal land. And then all of a sudden, I guess it maybe beginning in the late 50s or maybe even the 60s, people started focusing on the coast of South Carolina and Georgia and realizing what rich and beautiful land was there on these islands. And they started, you know, building, you know, developments and retiring there. But Penn Center is, St. Helena itself is a holdout. Penn Center has worked with all along the coast on heirs' property. But, you know, have, in some parts, the holding on to a lot of the land has not been as successful as St. Helena. Hilton Head is an excellent example of that.
Yeah.
Where it has just become developed and developed and developed, and people have just been pushed and pushed and pushed. But you still have, you know, significant land ownership, Gullah Geechee land ownership on Hilton Head. But St. Helena is one of those islands that remained majority African American for years. Now the trend is, you know, is slowly catching up with us, but Penn Center has played a major role in helping heirs property owners hold on to their land and helping them pay those taxes and understanding what, you know, and understanding the tax laws and not losing that land in tax sales and doing everything they can to have that happen. And we still have a major land project right today. We're going to have a major conversation of just about the subject in February, where we're bringing in major scholars on this issue and the community together to talk about it. But the amazing thing, I just read a couple of days ago, and I'm talking about Hilton Head now, where in the last tax sale in October, there no Gullah Geechee land was sold, went up for sale. No Gullah Geechee on the Hilton Head side. I don't think very, very many places on the St. Helena side went up for sale either. So that tells me that I think that we are having an impact on this battle.
Well, and I think the real estate developers, they come in, especially after hurricanes or big storms, and they try to sweet talk these people out of their land. And you guys, and through your informational campaign, have shown them, no, don't. This is, you are going to end up on the wrong side of that deal anyway from Sunday. So you got it. I think that's wonderful. Whoever came up with this plan, my God, is that progressive? Because you're right. It's land that generally, starting since the 1980s, has been gobbled up and developed into the monstrosity mansions. And you've been able to maintain the culture. And I think that is so important.
Right. And the land is so tied to the culture. You're right. If you lose that land, you lose the culture. People are so tied and embedded in their land. And one way that the developers have done what they've done over the years, they, you know, with Ayers property, and that's why the Ayers property arrangement became so, in a way, dangerous. I hate, that's a strong word, but it's because they would find one heir who was willing to sell their rights, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you find an heir that really needs money, and they sell their rights to a developer. And the first thing that the developer does, and like I remember what I said at the beginning of at the top of this conversation, is that a lot of this land was left in big parcels to families, and they call them family compounds. And the first thing that they do is they come in and if they get their hands on the rights to an heir's land, they come in and they build a fence.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that poem by Robert Frost? They build a wall, they build a fence.
Mm-hmm.
And then people have a hard time even getting, sometimes that occurs, have a hard time even getting access to their own land when that occurs. Some of that has subsided a bit with education, the education that Penn Center has been doing around Ayers properties. And I don't know whether I ever did, on the last conversation I told you about one of the most successful Ayers property projects that occurred on St. Helena.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dolores, we are actually running out of time, but here's what I'm going to promise, because you and I still haven't touched really that much on the Gullah history, and we need to, I think, break that down a little bit more, and we could come back and talk about this, because we just burned out an hour real fast, and I still want to make sure I mention that this is so important. As you just heard, as you're hearing Dolores, it is wildly important that we preserve this history. It is insanely important. PennCenter.com/donate. PennCenter.com/become a member as well. You just go to PennCenter.com. You'll find all the links there. And Dolores, really quick here, you got the Mellon Project. You got some classes coming up here in 2022, which people can find out more about on the website as well, right?
Right, absolutely. Go to the website, and we are about to launch a beautiful new website. So go to the website, and the Mellon Project will be launching in June of 2022. We'll have some fantastic classes and workshops, this is a partnership between UGA, the Wilson Humanities Center at UGA, and Penn Center. And so definitely go and look and see what all is going to be happening with that project.
And like I said, you can find out about the projects that are going on there. Donate if you can, penncenter.com/donate. Become a member. Or if I can encourage you, because the area of this country is just magnificent, go down and visit. You'll have a good time. It's a magnificent part of the country, a very underrated. You can kind of avoid Hilton Head per se and just stay in Beaufort and go and visit St. Helena Island, Penn Center. There's a lot there. I mean, you don't need to go to Hilton Head. There's so much there, and there's so many great beaches and fun things to do. I highly encourage it, and you'll expand your history. Dolores Pringle, once again, a trustee from the Penn Center. Dolores, I'm going to have you back. We have more to discuss in a future interview. I love having you on. It's such an honor. It is an absolute privilege and an honor to chat with you. Thank you so very much. Dolores Pringle, kind enough to join us for the hour. We'll wrap up the hour when we come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Thank you, Matt, and happy holidays again.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Thank you very, very much to Dolores Pringle from the Penn Center for joining us for this entire hour. As you just heard, that is such an important historical site. Please become a member, donate. If you get the chance to go visit, my gosh, Beaufort, South Carolina, the area, the town that's right next to is gorgeous. I highly encourage it. A fantastic vacation spot, but as well, a place of historic importance that we cannot overlook, not anymore. Fantastic interview. Coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, Sarah Wasserman, author, The Death of Things. She's going to be joining us. Plus, Terry John Zeeler, our food guy. We're going to talk holiday cooking with him. That's all coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. So stay with us. It's a brand new to you show right here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Into the 5 o'clock hour we go. Good to be with you. Well, actually not with you. Once again, it's a brand new to you show here. We're not here right now. It's the holidays. We're hoping you're having a wonderful holiday season no matter what you're doing. All our best from everyone at AM 950. This hour, I got to tell you, this book, I really like this book. Sarah Wasserman joins us. The book is The Death of Things. It talks about the disposable nature of our culture, especially in writing. It's a wonderful book, very kind of perverse, a little thinky, but one of my favorite interviews we did this entire holiday season. Sarah Wasserman, The Death of Things, that's coming up first. Then, in the second segment, coming up after her, Terry John Zeeler, our food guy, talks with us about holiday cooking. Some great ideas he has for holidays. Gets you right into that holiday spirit no matter where you're at. So that's coming up. Sarah Wasserman, Terry John Zeeler. That's the hour, the 5 o'clock hour, right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. I'm very interested in a concept that I read about in the latest book from Sarah Wasserman, The Death of Things, Ephemera and the American Novel. It talks about how our literature has changed, and especially how we talk about things within literature. I'll get into it. It's a little weighty, but I tell you what, it's actually, I think, an important observation made by Sarah Wasserman, an assistant professor of English and Material Cultural Studies at the University of Delaware and a co-editor of the Cultures of Obsolescence, History, Materiality, and the Digital Age. And she's kind enough to join us to talk about the book. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks so much for having me today.
Thank you very much for joining us. I want to start actually out with your job and the material studies. And also, it sounds like there's an institute at the University of Delaware that you're involved with as well that talks about material issues, right?
That's right. So I'm currently the associate director of the Center for Material Culture Studies at the University of Delaware, which has actually been around for 20, going on 21 years.
Wow.
And that term sounds funny, right? What is material culture? And it just breaks down into the two words in the term. So material, objects, artifacts, and culture, the way people interact with and make their world. So really, we are a group of faculty and graduate students and undergraduate students coming from all different disciplines, mostly in the humanities, studying how the objects that we use, that come up in the archive, that we dig up from history, how they make meaning and what they can tell us about the way that we live in the world now, we used to live in the world, we might live in the world in the future.
The idea of your book here that is interesting is ephemera. And I want, why don't you take a few minutes here and try to explain the best you can, because I find it wonderful when someone takes something very heady, very complicated, very, very thick as far as kind of an academic standard, but tries to convey it, because I think it does have cultural and societal importance. What you have discovered, I think, is very important for us actually to acknowledge. So why don't you just take a little bit and explain exactly what ephemera is?
Sure. Well, thanks for the kind words about the book and what I'm trying to do. And you're absolutely right to ask the question. All the time people say, ephemera, what are you actually talking about? It's a slightly esoteric term, and it comes from the Greek epi, which means on or upon. We know that from something like Epicurus. And hemera actually means day. So the term originally alluded to short-lived flowers and insects, like the mayfly, which are actually called ephemeroptera because they were thought to only live for one day. But basically, around 1700 or mid-1700s, the term had broader application, and it especially referred to paper objects that aren't meant to last. So if you've ever had one of those calendars where you tear off one day at a time and, you know, you toss it in the trash after, that's a great example of ephemera. I'm expanding that definition a little bit in the book to think about all the different kinds of objects in our world that aren't meant to last. So ephemera, basically, for me, are objects that signal their own disappearance or destruction. They come to us in their way and they say, you know, I'm not going to be here tomorrow. So that includes things like ticket stubs and pamphlets, but also in the book, it can include things like pop-up spaces and billboards and signage in cities that don't last, that are sort of meant to turn over and disappear. And I'm really interested in why so many of our favorite, most famous novelists from the 20th century in America were actually writing about ephemera in their novels. They're giving us these literary portraits of disappearing objects, and I wanted to know why.
And it's that point there which I thought was, wow, you nailed it, is that you noticed in books, post-war, World War II books, that the way the authors talked about those things changed. And it really has changed today. I mean, it's a very different world in regards to literature today versus what it used to be.
That's right. And I'm happy to talk, you know, about the literature in particular and talk about these authors, whether it's Rolf Ellison or Philip Roth or Marilyn Robinson, who really write about these disappearing objects. But I think you're raising a broader point, which is probably very interesting to your listeners, about our relationship to objects right now. Mm-hmm. That ephemera, for me, feels like a really important concept, not only because it comes out of this literature where authors were looking at the world around them and in post-war America and saying, hey, nothing's built to last. Everything turns over. Everything changes. And what does that say about us? But you're also pointing to the fact that right now we're in a moment where so many of our objects feel fleeting. They feel transient, you know, digital objects in particular. Do they have a materiality? Are they ever really ours? So This concept of ephemera that I think 20th century fiction explains so well has a really contemporary weight to it also.
And you just, and one of the things you just said is kind of signified there is that it's a double-edged sword to a point. And on one side, it is the promise, the future, the American way, but it's also the lack of delivering on the future and the promise that, you know, it's not Star Trek out there. We're supposed to, where are the things that you wave over me that make me healthy? No, we don't have that. And so it's almost as a way, it is a really kind of a bittersweet sort of aspect of literature, because on one side of it, it is, you know, you can find great value in the fleeting things. You can as well, and they can have great significance and make wonderful plot points in these things, but they also do represent to a point the failure of society to achieve those weightier ideas that we kind of come to expect. And instead of, you know, having the thing that makes me a beef Wellington every night just out of molecules, I got got a bag of Funyuns from the 7-Eleven. And I mean, that's I think a bitterness that comes with that to a point.
I love the way you've put this as saying it's bittersweet. And a great example that I talk about in the book is the 1939 New York World's
Fair.
So the actual World's Fair in 1939, it was called the World of Tomorrow. And there were these models of cities of the future. We were going to have hoverports and robots smoking cigarettes. And as you said, you know, a button you would press to make you your beef Wellington. And of course, not only did that not happen, but the fair closes and they melt down the structures, the buildings of the fair, and they turn them into metal for the war effort. So literally the dreams of tomorrow end up in bullets and steel casings for the war. And this is, I think, a really great example that gets captured in E.L. Doctorow's novel World's Fair and Michael Chabon's The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And these writers are really talking not about, ooh, these shiny promises, right? They're talking about how those shiny promises didn't come true and where we end up instead. So you're right that even while we might think about our own collections of ephemera, if you have, say, ticket stubs or something like that, they can be a really sweet reminder of things you've done in the past and experiences you've had. But they can also, as you're saying, at a bigger scale, be very bitter when they tell us some truths about where we are today with our material relations.
You bring up World's Fairs, and I thought that could that be the first real mega case of ephemera on the planet was the World's Fair? Because I remember reading a book about Garfield, and he was touring the World's Fair when he was getting ready to run for president. And he was talking about the big thing back then was they were trying to get doctors to wash their hands. I mean, that's kind of what they're, you know, you scrub your hands, it's a good thing. But they talked about the building where this was at was all long gone and all this stuff, and the same kind of concept. I remember reading the Devil in the White City about the Chicago World's Fair, and that most of that is completely gone as well. I mean, you bring that in. I mean, I think that that's such a wonderful example of this because quite literally it might be the largest scale exhibit of ephemera and probably one of the earliest versions of it that really kind of captures our modern mentality of it that is available.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, World Fairs are such interesting case studies because, of course, things do survive, whether it's the Ferris wheel in Chicago or the Space Needle in Seattle. But most of it and the event itself vanishes and disappears. So I think you're absolutely right that it is one of the earliest and simply most important, if you want to say monumental instances of ephemera, to say something a little bit paradoxical. But I would also, you know, say and pose as a question whether or not city spaces themselves, which we think of as kind of permanent. We think of them as landscape. We think of them as the space we inhabit where other things disappear, that city spaces are so often turning over and changing that they're another big scale, large scale instance of ephemera. It's what a lot of Europeans, when they came to this country in, you know, the 1900s, would comment on as being uniquely American. They would say there are no ruins and everything just gets torn down and disappears in American cities. And that's so strange. There's no sense of history. So I think once you take the concept of ephemera from that mayfly and that paper calendar, and you start to think about it not just as an object, but as a logic or as a relationship that we have to objects in this country, you can get very big with it quite quickly.
Two things about that. One, I talked to Larry Millette, who's an architectural writer out here, used to work for the St. Paul Pioneer Press many years ago. And he talked about this with the Metrodome, when they tore down the Metrodome to build what's now U.S. Bank Stadium, where the Minnesota Vikings play. And I asked him about the historical nature. He goes, of course it's historical. The Rolling Stones played there. Twins won two World Series in the place. I mean, of course you are, but you're exactly right. That's gone. That's yesterday. We need to move on. And that does happen on a large scale event. And now that you pointed out, it really is. It is kind of the American way. The other one is this, and you'll get a kick out of this. I drive home every day from the radio station. I drive down KTEL Drive. Yes, that KTEL Drive, where the magic microphone and the pocket fisherman and all those things came from. And it is one of those things where the when you talk about this, I mean, we have a society that's almost based on this. It's easy to see how literature now. Once you pointed this out, it's so easy to see why literature has embraced this to a point, because it is what America has kind of become.
Yeah, you know, I think let me ask you a question that will seem like a tangent, but I think it's meaningful. Do you somewhere in your home have a box of either VHS tapes or DVDs or cassettes or CDs?
Yes, I do.
Yes. Okay. So almost everyone, at least everyone above a certain age, has one of these boxes. And every time you move, it's a crisis, right? Because you don't know, do I keep it? Do I throw it away? What do I do with this? And that's really related to this thing we're talking about, right? Which is the technology turns over so quickly, and then you have this remainder that you don't know what to do with. Ephemera are a little bit different because in theory, at least, you don't have that remainder that, you know, if you don't have your iPhone 3 anymore, if you're on the 13, it's gone, it's away. And ephemera are objects that are designed to go away in that particular sense. And why I think literature is so good at teaching us about this is because when you read a book, it's not like your box of VHS tapes, hopefully for a number of reasons, but it's not like your box of VHS tapes or CDs because the objects that are being described aren't actually there. An author might conjure them up and we imagine them in the course of reading the novel, but it's not like going to a museum where you see the object, or it's not like confronting that box of old media you have in your basement. So novels, I think, are very good at capturing not just what the ephemera were, what they looked like, what they meant, but also the way that their disappearance matters. That is, in a novel, you can also portray the lost. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying about many things is that we're not very good at as a culture necessarily at dealing with that loss, even though it's really baked into our way of being.
Mm-hmm. But if I may, when I talk about something like K-Tel, that is, I think of that somewhat differently than a box of CDs, because I do have a box of CDs, and do I even have a CD player? Now, that's an interesting question, because I did have a CD player when I had all intention. I said if I had to, you know, if for some reason the only technology that was working was technology from the 1990s, I'm good. But, you know, I still had that. The difference when I talk about stuff like K-Tel, it was designed to be used. It was designed to be broken because it was made cheap and it wasn't made be used a lot. And sure, there might be a magic microphone in some, you know, history, you know, modern art museum someplace. But the reality is those things are not in boxes. They were made almost to be used, destroyed, thrown out, and gone. And I think that's what I'm talking about in that sense, is that VHS tapes or CDs, there still might be some continued value there, but no one has, you know, the love of an ancient piece of mail order technology that broke 5 seconds afterwards, and no one has anymore. I mean, that's kind of that part of which is gone, and yet you could still bring it back to the common cultural consciousness by including it in a book and say, oh, yeah, I remember when we had one of those. But no one would, you know, it's gone from most people's mindset as it is.
Right, yeah. And part of what you're making me think about is the fact that one reason why people are really drawn to ephemera. And so when I go to a place and I talk about my work, there are inevitably some people in the audience who have their prized ephemera with them, or they have a collection of ephemera and they want to talk about these things that they saved that they love. And what you're saying about K-Tel and it's from its inception, it's designed to not necessarily last. You know, it can make a thing more precious as well. It can make something seem rare. It can be that sort of one time only, get here and interact with it before it's gone. Sometimes we're aware of that at the start and sometimes maybe less so. But it's not just that ephemera are designed to disappear and then become valueless. Mm-hmm. That they hold all different kinds of value. And the ones that last or that often remain, they do so because people see value in them, because they care. And I suppose that I'm interested in the very different ways in which ephemera can remain. They can be somewhere in a museum, they can be in a box at home, or in a different way, they can be stored, in a sense, in a novel.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think of, I mean, you talk about the author of the book from the World's Fair on 39, and how much you loved, and I saw one of your interviews and how much you really did enjoy the description of his second trip to the World's Fair. And yeah. and I saw that was kind of interesting. Who do you think today, as far as authors, capture this idea best right now?
Ooh, people writing right now?
Yeah.
That's a great question. So I suppose my attention and interest since completing this book has turned more toward novels that are explicitly about the internet. So they aren't necessarily writing about ephemera in the way that the authors in my first book are, but they're still thinking about what lasts, what remains, what disappears, and in particular, what does the internet do to all of these concepts of preservation and memory and
yes.
endurance. And so I've been reading a lot of novels on that topic lately. I've been reading Patricia Lockwood and Lauren Euler, who are two young female authors writing about in different ways, how everything is ephemeral on the internet, including our own identities. I really liked a book by Hari Kundru that called Red Pill, which is about conspiracy theories and whether or not we can trust any of our own impulses about what's real, including the material world. So there's a lot of interesting fiction, I think, being written that addresses the concepts of the book, if not the material dimension, so directly.
Do you think, as you brought that up, do you feel as if there's an element of epiphany that comes through for the characters of these novels that makes that the ephemeral element of it, you know, work better? I mean, there it does feel like that is part of it. Is that, yeah, as we talked about before, the feeling, the failure of the promise of the future, that sort of thing is a context that's used in. Do you feel as if an epiphany generally is kind of in conjunction with it in the books?
Oh, you're such a good reader. If only all readers were like you. Yes. my simple answer is yes, and the longer answer is simply that even if it's not presented as a dramatic, you know, lightning bolt over the head kind of epiphany, that I do think characters in novels, once they recognize that the material world is not permanent, that it also disappears, it is also transient, they start to learn the lesson that letting go of things is as important as holding on to them. And that can be a really poignant and painful lesson, but I think that's the kind of epiphany that many of the characters in these novels have, mm-hmm. where our impulse to grasp to things so tightly, the events in a novel will teach characters, and the ephemera in a novel will teach characters that they need to let go of things.
The minute I read about this and you talked about this, I started reading about this with your book. Now I can't not see it. Everything post-war. I mean, it is because it's interesting you bring up the post-war generation because of that generation. They came back from World War II, and it was suburbia, and it was the microwave oven, and it was all these things. I mean, there was that promise, and it does not surprise me that's where it began and where it's gone today. Wow.
Yeah, it's, you know, people who work in different periods of literature will say, we did this first, the modernists did it better, or the medievalists did it better. But what you're talking about, and what I address in the book, is in America at this time, we became a disposable culture. Not even the Great Depression could slow down Americans' desire for disposable goods, you know, paper plates and TV dinners. And there was something about this at this time that I think seemed really high tech. We weren't thinking about the environment, and we weren't thinking about planned obsolescence and how we were going to have to buy new gadgets all the time. We were enamored, I think, with the way that you could just have new things all the time, and the old ones seemed to disappear. So I do think there's a very historically and culturally specific dimension to this preoccupation with ephemera.
You and I, before we started talking, we talked about how it used to be about, you know, Citizen Kane was about Rosebud, which was a sled. Now it's today. And I said Funyuns, and then you beat me by a mile. You said it's actually a digital picture of Funyuns. And I said, yeah, there you go. I think that captures it pretty well. And the reality is it depends on how much you like Funyuns. And I think that's kind of the way the modern world works, is that you can have these differencing things and kind of this ephemera and this disposable nature of our society. But if you're happy, is it for anyone to really criticize? I don't know. I don't think so.
I think that we all have an imperative to criticize Funyuns. No, I'm joking. But I think that whether or not you like Funyuns, I appreciate what you're saying, which is we shouldn't judge. Don't yuck anyone's yum. Don't judge people's attachments. But I think the digital picture idea is so fascinating because my sense is that we have a double-edged anxiety about the internet and materiality. That on the one hand, we feel like, oh my gosh, if I post something to the internet or someone else posts it, I'm never going to be able to delete it. There have been legal battles over this, right? That your old Friendster account is still online, your Picasa account is floating around somewhere and you cannot get rid of it. So everything seems permanent, stored in the cloud, stored in this infinite storage. And on the other hand, it all seems entirely immaterial. Your photo album on your phone doesn't feel like a photo album you might have had in a bound binder with actual printed photographs. And so we're stuck in this moment, I think, where we don't quite understand whether or not things are truly material or truly immaterial. And that feels really contemporary. It feels really unique to the digital moment. But it's an old dynamic. It's the same dynamic that people in the 50s and 60s were writing about in novels about their objects.
And it's interesting when you put it back. I'll give you a great comparison of that. But go look at a letter to home from the Civil War. And it's like, my dearest Charlotte, it's been a tough campaign in the wilderness. Today, because of that, and I, just by what you just described, it's kind of like, it's hot here and it sucks, and it's a text message. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things where things have changed dramatically. I really want to encourage people to get this book. And I know, like I said, it is a thick subject, but my gosh, I think it gives you a better perspective of our modern culture, modern literature for sure. But as well, it goes even beyond that. And I think it makes us, at least for me, I think it makes me understand myself better, which I think is a good part of the book. If it can resonate like that, I think it's an important thing. The Death of Things, Ephemera, and the American Novel, Sarah Wasserman. Sarah, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. I'm glad to chat with you.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. One of my favorite guests we have on a few times every year, especially around the holidays, is Terry Johnzilla. He is a master chef, of course, an excellent baker. His wedding cakes, his cake business is exceptional. Of course, he makes the pies for my Thanksgiving meal, and they're fantastic. And also, by the way, your caramel rolls, man. Holy God, are those good. And he's going to be starting his own coffee shop. We'll start off with that, actually. That's going to be coming up here. Terry Johnzilla, our food guy extraordinaire, kind enough to join us today to talk about holidays and eating. Hi, Terry.
Well, hello.
I was just a few weeks ago, I went down and caught Fiddler at the Ordway down in Rice Park. I was right by where your new coffee shop's going to be opening up. I think you're doing a soft opening coming up here in the Winter Carnival area. Down by Rice Park. Where is that going to be at?
It's in the Osborne 370 building. It's actually the old Ecolab headquarters. New owners bought the building, and they've turned it into this great entrepreneurial center. And almost everyone in the building, even the bank that's located in the lobby, are all focused on small business, entrepreneurial spirit. And that's why they invited me to come on. And I'm very excited because, again, we're all of a similar mindset. And they wanted a draw. They wanted an amenity for their clients and the people around in the neighborhood. And I was so excited that they thought of me.
Well, and it's so perfect. Your food, you and I have talked about your food. I have tasted your food numerous times. It is magnificent. It will be lovely to have a regular Monday through Friday showcase for your cooking.
And then we're going to start off with, heavy pastries. We'll do quiche and, ham and cheese croissants. Mm. We're even working on a croissant dough-wrapped hot dog.
Damn!
Which I'm excited for. And then we'll launch the full, more of a lunch program in March. And then we'll launch the box lunch program in April. Because we want to do it incrementally, but we want to really knock it out of the ballpark at every level. So when we get to that next level of service, we're super prepared.
I got to ask you, of course, obviously coffee shop. How much do you know about coffee? Are you kind of going through educating yourself more on coffee as you're getting ready for this?
Actually, I'm working with a roaster, and the funny thing is that I like a good cappuccino, but I don't make them and I don't go out for them. I mean, I'll just have a diet soda. But the thing is, I like coffee in things, and that's where the appreciation comes in. Would I have a cup of coffee in the morning? I'm not a coffee guy. Would I have a cappuccino? Oh, yeah. But the whole thing is adding those flavors, to a chocolate tart or coffee in a rib recipe. I love coffee as an ingredient in things. So my love of the ingredient is what made me think, oh, great. If I didn't care for coffee in any way, it wouldn't be a good fit. But I do love it as a component. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how we'll kind of carry that through into some of the pastries and food that we're going to be serving.
Well, and then, of course, if you do get a cup of coffee to go with it, it just that's where the magic happens. When you have the coffee in the baking and then the cup of coffee to go with it, because then it becomes an adventure. It's not just something to eat with a cup of coffee. It's actually you know, simpatico. It's a union. It's fantastic.
And then we're going to be doing, of course, coffee, tea, cocoa, and then coffee, cappuccino, espresso, latte, those drinks. And then we'll have some syrups, but I don't want to do what I call, like, the Karen coffees, you know, the 2,000-calorie frappy wappy. Maybe down the road, but right now I just want to focus on good, solid coffee and cappuccino products.
Karen coffee has now entered my vernacular. I am not giving that up. If I wanted a melted sundae, I'd go get Dairy Queen and leave it in my car.
There we go.
So we are in, once again. So let's the soft opening. You're gonna begin this around the Winter Carnival.
Winter Carnival, and then our grand opening is Monday, February 7th. So we'll be open Monday through Friday from 7 to 5. I think that really suits the building,
okay.
And it suits the neighborhood, because since we're in an office building, we're in the lobby. But again, it's we'll see what happens on weekends, but I do think for that neighborhood, Monday through Friday is really going to be our core business.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not that there's not fun things to do. Like I said, I went over to the Ordway, caught Fiddler. They got the XL Energy Center and the Wild playing over there. But those are, you know, for you, it's going to be a Monday through Friday business. It's in the old Ecolab building. What's the new name of that building now?
Osborne 370.
All right. And so we'll definitely make sure we talk about that as well, especially as we get towards Winter Carnival. But let's since we're in the holiday season here, you and I talked a few weeks back about Thanksgiving, of course. Great ideas, as always, here. What is your favorite main course holiday meal over the Christmas season?
Well, the thing is, I cook it all the time for my catering business. I really love a whole roasted filet mignon. Because what I do is I heavy salt and pepper. I put a large rim baking sheet lined with foil in an oven, and I preheat the oven to about 500 to 550 degrees. And then I liberally salt the whole filet, and I trim it so I get all the hard fat cap off, all the gristle, and then just so lightly oiled with salt, pepper, some Italian seasoning, and then I have that tray heated. I put it in that hot oven, and then I dot it with butter, and then you roast it. And then I like to roast it till probably it's about 125, and then I pull it out in the middle, because that means the ends will be more well done for your guests that want that, and the center will be rare for your guests that want that.
You can't go wrong with what you just described. One problem I have is, can you cook the fat separately? Because I like to make Yorkshire pudding, which you need some of the drippings off of. I do a prime rib roast.
That's more of a prime rib issue.
Yeah.
Prime rib, a ribeye has the fat. A whole roasted filet has no fat.
Yes. All righty. So,
if you're going to do it, so I would never trim off the fat on a prime rib or a whole roasted ribeye, because the fat is the whole purpose of it.
Well, I'm not going to lie to you. you're speaking honest truth over there. And I always like making the Yorkshire pudding with the drippings. I mean, if you don't want to do that, is it popovers then is the option if you don't have the drippings?
Yeah, popovers are always a winner.
All right. The holidays, one of the things I don't like about the holidays is and it kind of goes back to your Karen Coffee comment, is that it's too over the top sometimes. It is way too sugary, way too pepperminty, you know, and way too, you know, kind of that cheap chocolatey kind of thing. You know, I like a good, I mean, my wife has a great old-fashioned sugar cookie recipe, which is just fantastic. I think that sometimes modern American holiday cooking and food is just way too over the top.
Well, I think the issue with that is when I look at recipes, and I have 3,000 cookbooks, and I actually just got two more today. I hope my assistant's not listening, because he'll just kill me that I got two more books. The thing is that when you find with American recipes, and I find, and this isn't bad about it, like the Pinterest-style recipes,
mm-hmm.
For the average home baker, the level of sugar is almost oppressive, and they'll use recipes that have margarine rather than butter, which is actually has another layer of that ting to it, that kind of, that, how do I say it? And I don't want to belittle it, but it becomes very pedestrian.
It's a different chemical. I mean, baking is chemistry. It's a different chemical makeup. And I mean, it does margarine taste very different than butter.
Now, I find, here's the deal, though. I've actually used vegan butter or like plant-based butter for some of my clients who cannot have cow's milk. And I found if used properly, it's great. But the whole thing is it's all about the quality.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the plant-based butter is not cheap. But, boy, does it work. The margarines, the problem is that you're basically using hydrogenated oil. Now, a lot of people don't know this about the margarines. They think, I don't want to do dairy. Well, there's whey in most margarines.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, so, it's a lot of whipped oil, too.
It's a lot of whipped oil, but also with the sugar. Here's another thing, is though, too. And I was baking for another baker, doing some doughs for them, and they had brought me beet sugar. Now, I will tell you, and this is your listeners need to know this, use cane sugar, because when we opened up that canister, it smelled like beets. Mm. And the problem is, yes, it's a little cheaper, but what happens is that if you can smell it, you'll be able to taste it. And that's what kind of gets that, you know, those grocery store sugar cookies that you see everywhere that you know some company's making them and selling them to all the grocery stores?
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about, that sweet. And it's an odd sweetness. And that comes from the beet sugar rather than cane sugar.
Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned sheep, and I think that that's a key mistake that sometimes gets made. It's not something, I mean, if you're going to bake, you want to bake stuff that's nice. You generally don't want to go with the cheapest option for the ingredients, because that has a tendency of biting you in the caboose.
It really does. And the whole thing is, I always say, people go, well, we're on a budget or things have been tough. Well, then, I mean, go with less of it. And I think that's where you can really have a great meal. Yes, a prime rib is horribly expensive. And most people, it's kind of out of the range, because a prime rib can cost a couple hundred dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But what you could do is get a few couple beautiful ribeye steaks, slice them and fan them, and have everyone have a little bit of something spectacular.
Yes, and you can. So it's kind of one of those things where we're not trying to discourage you from doing the cooking. But at the same time, as you said, you know, beet sugar, margarine. I mean, they're cheaper, but generally the issue you get is a flavor quality issue. I have found we inherited a few church cookbooks that are ancient. I'm guessing not ancient, like 1940s, maybe 1950s. And yeah, there's some atrocious recipes in there. But at the same time, when it comes to the baking, it's, as you say, butter, flour, traditional cane sugar, and the products you get out of there, because they were making things, they didn't have the variety. To a point, it was just, they had the base products, and you get, I think, a better quality of bake off of some of those old-fashioned church cookbooks.
Well, and my very first cookbook was called The Complete Pie Cookbook. I got it. It was published in 66, so it was before I think it was even born. But I bought it, and I think I got it when I was 12. It's in tatters. I have a new copy of it on my bookshelf, but I still use that old book because it all works. And yes, some of the recipes, like there's this odd gelatinous fish pie recipe that I will never make. But there is something about that old school, and they work because, you know, it works.
It does. It just does. And I have tried to make cookies, and I've got some very good cookbooks. I'm a big fan of the King Arthur Flour Cookbook. That's a very good cookbook.
Yeah, they do a spectacular job.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'll find some, you know, here's Agnes's, you know, sugar cookie recipe from 1942 from, you know, St. Mark's Lutheran, and it's like, wow, this actually makes an insanely tasty cookie.
What I find is interesting when we talk about recipes, when you go, say, on the Pinterest and all the sites, often I think it's interesting, or you Google a recipe that you want to cook, you want to bake, whatever, and you'll notice that a lot of these bloggers, it's the same recipe. A lot of them aren't using the recipe, or they're using substitutions. So that's why people go, well, you can get every recipe online. You really can't, because when someone's taking the time to write a book, a lot more thought went in there than someone who took someone else's recipe and wants to write the damn story beforehand. You know, where you got to read the whole story about their daughter or their dog or their whatever tragedy or joyful experience that made them want to bake this. And then you get the recipe that's printed on 24 other blogger sites.
So Grandpa survived the fall off the cliff. Now here's my tater tot hot dish. I'm like, geez, why are you doing this? Stop. I couldn't agree with you more. I don't need the backstory. I think you need to write something else, maybe a blog, but not recipes.
I am so sorry about your tumor, but let's move on.
I want to get into one of the things that I enjoy quite a bit, Great British Baking Show. And the reality is,
oh my God, I love it. I love that show.
They eat so much more gingerbread than we do. I was at the store this morning. I'm going through it. They have that pieced together, pre-made gingerbread house. And I already know that's going to be atrocious. But you get into a complicated thing here, because to make a gingerbread house, you do have to have some level of ability in the kitchen to be able to design and bake, cut out and bake gingerbread in the shape of a house. I mean, is it in your mind, is it too difficult? If you want to do one that's actually going to be edible, you really have to do it yourself, right?
Yeah, and here's the whole thing as well, is that they actually make gingerbread house templates, where you make the dough and then you can cut out the pieces.
Okay.
And I'm all for that. Now, what I find is, if you look for a Swedish gingerbread, that will be the texture you're looking for. Because it will be crisp. The problem is, some gingerbreads are softer, and the house will collapse.
Okay. You said Swedish, right?
Yeah, it's like a Swedish gingerbread is generally what they're using. Now, I have a thing about the British baking show.
Yeah.
Yes, they love ginger, but boy, are they obsessed with mango and passion fruit.
Oh, they do. And cardamom. So what's with all the cardamom? They love
that. I think it's all about any country that you conquered and pillaged.
No,
you sure want to have the things that you took over the country for. So I think that mango and passion fruit, God bless colonialism. And the British did perfect it.
They're wiping away their tears of their lost colonies as they make up the food.
But they are obsessed with mango and passion fruit.
Oh, they are. I love that show, and it does give you some great ideas as far as baking goes. But I guess that's the thing, is that with the holidays, it has become as well. Not only do we talk about the sweetness sometimes, it's sometimes sensational. Now, if I want a display piece, Terry John Zeela, your baking is second to none. Let's make sure we mention your cake business here really quick. That if people are interested, they want to get something for the holidays, a cake from you, who do they get in touch with? How do they get in touch with you?
Well, if you just Google my name, Terry John Zeela, all the information comes up. If you want to, like, Jean Juan is my pastry division, and then Terry John Zeela Catering is like a savory division. And there are websites for both of those. But again, if you just Google me, all the information comes up. I'm very easy to find.
Well, with John,
thank God I don't have a prison record.
Don't search Matt McNeil. John Juan, the cakes. If you want a display piece, if you want something that's going to be really nice, you want to kind of talk to Terry. He'll get you something spectacular. But this idea of kind of this pure one. Kind of homestead, kind of Karen kind of mentality. I've got to make at home this five-layered cake sort of thing. I think sometimes the holidays, it's not about one-upping each other. I got a great recipe for just a simple cheesecake that you put some chocolate and you put some, you break up some candy canes and put it in there, and it's magnificent. And it's not over the top. Yeah, I still have to make a cheesecake, but it's relatively easy. I think that sometimes people have to walk away because, yes, the holidays gives you this impression that everything has to be to the nth degree.
You know, and I think also, too, and I tell people, my clients this all the time, sometimes people get overwhelmed. And if I can't do a party for them, I'll say, don't be ashamed. There are good bakeries in town. Even like Costco has spectacular meats and some pre-made things. Don't think that you have to make everything from scratch, because when you're doing, a dinner buffet of 10, 15 things, for the home cook, most people aren't going to notice, and no one's going to call you out for it.
No, I would hope not.
One thing, though, I will say, shrimp cocktail.
Okay.
Everyone likes shrimp cocktail.
Yes.
Please do not buy pre-cooked shrimp.
Okay.
I just hate it. For me, I do in a big pot with about probably maybe 2 cups of milk, a cup of lemon juice. I do a little crab boil, Old Bay seasoning, salt, pepper, a tablespoon of sugar. You bring that to a boil, and you add it's a U21 to 24 shrimp. U means how many per pound. Tail on, for cripe's sakes, it's the best shrimp. And watch it. Don't overcook it. The minute they've curled, they are ready.
Well, you bring it up, and this is, you're right. There's a lot of people that do the pre-cooked shrimp. It's rubbery. It's not very good. It's the difference.
And also, it's watery.
Yeah, it is, actually. Yeah, it is. I mean, I grew up in Rhode Island. You know that. I grew up out by Point Judith Mussels, and sometimes you'll find them pre-cooked, and they're just garbage. You got to find the fresh ones and cook them up. Or tell me one person that's ever gotten a TV dinner that said, wow, that was a good steak. No, anytime you have a pre-cooked thing, it's not going to be good quality. And so 100%.
And also what I do with my shrimp cocktail is I boil them from frozen.
Okay.
And then just watch them. And people go, well, how do I know if they're done? Well, if you get a 2-pound bag of shrimp, you're going to have a lot of shrimp. Take one out and taste it. Cut it. I mean, that's how you know. And then also, too, obviously most people don't have a blast chiller. The minute those shrimp are out of the pot, strain them and either rinse them with cold water or put them on a rim baking sheet and then pop them in the freezer just to get that heat off of them so they don't keep cooking.
And that's important too. You definitely got to cool them down after you boil them, because if you don't, they'll like any meat, they'll just keep cooking.
Well, but also, and shrimp is so fussy.
Yeah,
it gets just like, I mean, it's amazing how it goes from really that kind of great little crunch to a little curl shape of rubber.
Once again, by the way, what's going to be the? Do you know what the name of your new coffee shop is going to be?
It's going to be called Hepcat Coffee.
Hepcat Coffee.
We went and looked at the place. It's kind of like a 20s vibe, but they did the whole kind of a mid-century modern, even though it's a different era. And then my assistant, Tom, we'd gone and looked at the space, and then the next day he goes, we should do it. Mm-hmm. So, and he goes, how about Hepcat? And we're standing in my kitchen. I go to GoDaddy.com. I type in HepcatCoffee.com. Nobody owned it, and I bought it.
Nice. Hepcat Coffee is going to be a soft opening over the Winter Carnival. We'll have Terry on before that to talk about that. And, of course, they're opening for good starting on Monday, February 7th, Monday through Friday. That's going to be over in the Osborne 370 building, the old Ecolab building in downtown St. Paul. Terry, happy holidays. All my best, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Always, my friend, always. And Terry John Zeeler, we'll take a break. Come on back. The Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Thank you very much, Terry Azila. Gosh, I always love talking with Terry. Man, I always get hungry after talking with Terry Azila, for sure. And Sarah Wasserman, what a wonderful book, The Death of Things. It's an interesting topic and a fascinating topic, and it tells you a lot about how smart and charismatic Sarah Wasserman is when you listen to her talk about that book. It is fantastic. Highly recommend. Highly, highly, highly recommend that book. Happy holidays from everyone here at AM 950 Radio. We hope you're having a wonderful and safe holiday. Be careful. All our best. And once again, we do hope you're having a wonderful holiday season. Thank you very much for being with us. A brand new to you show today. We've got a brand new to you show coming up tomorrow right here on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.